code's Kill Kittens and customer service is an oxymoron. One podcast has set out to make things right. This is the Unpodcast with your hosts, Scott Stratton and Allison Kramer.
Live from Oakville, Ontario, this is the Unpodcast. It's like I wanted to be a DJ.
You really need to not use that DJ voice.
Why not, Allison?
It freaks me out.
Sometimes people complain about my lack of clarity and enunciation.
No one except yourself has ever complained about your lack of clarity.
Four people have.
Like in your life or on the podcast?
For the show. Which out of seven listeners.
Who are these four people?
I can name them right now.
I need their email addresses and their names.
Oh, the trials and tribulations of the podcast world and the host. Just watched a couple weeks ago. Graham Elwood, a friend of ours, a friend of the show, is a comedian in LA, came out with a podcast documentary. What was it called? Earbuds.
Research.
Was it Earbuds? I think it was.
Anyway, I don't know what it was called.
I just thought of it right now about the podcasting world. And
you get home from trips, you tell me stories, I smile at you. I'm not always paying attention.
That's very honest.
I got Wayne to laugh.
That's very honest and raw of you.
I don't know what the podcast documentary was called. I do remember you mentioning it, but I don't remember what the name of it was. I got it.
Earbuds, yeah. The podcasting documentary.
And so you should have gone with it. You knew it.
Yeah, I did, and I wavered.
So was he promoting the documentary, or is he in development? Stage?
No, it's out. It's out. Yeah. It's out. So when we met him at...
It was CES.
CES or NAB, yeah, in
maybe
Vegas.
It was NAB.
And a great guy. And he runs the podcast, the big conference trade show type of thingy in LA as well, which I don't remember, Podcast Movement, I believe it is. It's a really great documentary. I really liked it. It was about what podcasting has done for people. It wasn't about podcast and the growth and the numbers necessarily. It was the stories, which is what podcasting is about. And they went, Graham and his co-host of their show, which is the Comedy Film Nerds podcast, I believe. I'm butchering all of this, Graham. I'm sorry if you're listening to this. And if you're not, well, then I can butcher it all I want. And they actually flew around and met some of the biggest fans of their show. They flew overseas on the other side of the world. And
to meet people who listen to that?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, and then interviewed, obviously, all these people who do podcasting as well. A lot of comedians, but a lot of people who also host non-comedy type of shows. And one of the people they met over in Asia, she was tweeting during the tsunami.
Oh, goodness.
And she was talking to the hosts of the show and their fellow fans, because that's who she had reaching out to immediately at the time. And there was such an incredible story, an incredible bond, and how they all felt made her feel less alone during this whole thing and less scared. And everybody was concerned. Everybody kept following up. And it was like a hashtag going with it and everything else. It was such a great human story and multiple human stories in the documentary itself. So I would listen. I'd go watch it. I think it's great. It was really well done. And, you know,
it's a really intimate medium. Like, it's so, you know, the fans that we have for the on podcasts, if so much more connected to us and what we do than the fans of any of the other things that we've done.
Right.
So I think it kind of has the ability to form those kinds of connections between people. I like it.
And we got that note from somebody yesterday. Lisa Borner said, thank you so much for accepting my request to connect. That's on LinkedIn. I want to take this opportunity to thank you and Allison for helping me through some really tough times last year. Robert and Joe, who's the people from Content Marketing Institute, had just announced to the end of This Old Marketing, the show I had never missed an episode of for the past few years. I was heartbroken, devastated, and disappointed. But then, like a new and fresh silver lining at the horizon, I discovered the Unpodcast. I must admit that I've been binge listening to whenever I had the time since then. Being a foreign B2B marketer with a passion for gobbledygook-free human writing and valuable fun content, life in corporate Japan can be, rough at times, to say the least. So listening to Allison and you talking about marketing-related stories in your own unique way is not only highly entertaining, although giggling randomly in public still makes me feel quite awkward, but hey, I'm a weird alien here anyway, so who cares, but also gives me hope that I'm not alone with my crazy dreams of fun and enjoyable marketing. A big arigato gozaimasu to you and Allison and the rest of the crew. That's you, Wayne. for filling my days, as well as the days of the other six listeners, with new discoveries and laughter. I look forward to the next episode of the Unpodcast. Best regards from Tokyo, Lisa.
Oh, that's nice. Thank you, Lisa. I hope you're listening now.
Yeah, that makes it It's cool, right? It's like getting the picture of somebody reading the book on a beach in Istanbul, or be like, it's just, you can reach people that you can't physically go to a lot of the times. And it is intimate. It is really...
It is, yeah.
It's just you and the listener for the most part, until the parents accept their children to it on road trips places, which is... Hello to everybody on a road trip right
cruel
now.
And unusual.
On today's show, same as always. Brands and making you think, what? Why? And for us to straighten it out for you. So let's jump in right away. This is a tweet from Will Knight. He shared a picture and it said, a human Uber developed in Japan provides a way to attend events remotely using another person's body. It's surprisingly natural, says its inventor, Jin Rekimoto of Sony. Hashtag EM Tech Asia. And this is...
The picture is incredible.
It's just people walking around with helmets and iPads on their faces with somebody else's face in it. It's like Phil in Modern Family with that, you know, those little weird robots that go around with iPads and wheels and you can control it like
Except
you're there.
It's weirder because it's a person. So it's like if I paid you money to go to an event for me.
Right.
And so you put an iPad on your face and you have my face on it.
Yeah.
And then... You're filming it, and I'm watching it at home.
Yeah,
it is one of the weirdest things I've ever
seen. It's your comfort surrogate, right? It's somebody going in your stead. It's like what was that? Arrested Development did that with us. Dave Osborne walked around, and he had the headset on and the microphone, and he repeated whatever the person said. Same thing.
Incredible.
I love it. It was beautiful. I have 50% of me thinks it's a joke, and the other half hopes it's not. So. Well done. I know what to get you
for Valentine's Day. Yeah.
Keynote's coming soon with a human Uber.
A Scott surrogate at the keynote.
We have to have a clip-on man bun. Right? That works. That's an attachment. That's an accessory. Off we go.
I'm trying to picture what the man bun would look like with the iPad screen in the front.
It's in development.
It is. It's in development.
Patent pending.
I have a story from thehustle.co. It says, so we had spoken about Amazon Go probably a couple months ago, maybe even longer. It might have even been a year ago when they were just talking about it, right? This idea that Amazon's developing a grocery store where you go in and you don't have to pay. Like you have your phone with you, you walk through, somehow the cart senses what you've put into it. It automatically charges you and then you just walk out with your cart full of things. And you're automatically charged for it. And so we wanted to talk about this because it's actually happened. Like they've opened some stores. So there's an 1,800 square foot market and customers come in and it's all fully stocked just like your regular grocery store. And it's the same thing. No staff, like no cashiers anyway. I'm sure there must be people working in the grocery store, but no cashiers. And you just kind of like go through and it says something like the technology is kind of being kept secret. Like Amazon's not totally sharing. Probably because it's still so new and they don't want someone else, I guess, to use the technology. But why we want to talk about it is because there's been some reports of like crazy long lines of people waiting to get into the store because there won't be lines once they're
to check
inside
out.
The store. And so I thought that was so funny. I'm like, why? Like, why? I don't understand. I do. I mean, but I do self-checkout.
Yeah. But I love this. As somebody who is very... particular about the packing of the groceries after the purchase of the groceries.
But why isn't there a line to pack your groceries?
Well, I see, what I love about this is that there's so much redundancy in grocery shopping. I take the item, I put it in my cart, I got to take it out of the cart and put it on the little conveyor belt, and then I got to put it in a bag and put it back in the cart. Too many steps.
Except that you put your groceries into bags, so you can then put the bags into your car and take them into your house.
Right. So when I'm shopping, I bring the bags with me when I go in, into my cart, put the items in the bags, in the cart, walk out, bags packed.
All right. I have an important question for you. Okay. So as we've talked about before on the show, Scott is extremely, some could say anal.
Whoa.
Other would say, you know, serious about how groceries are packed. Now, do you have to change the way you shop in the grocery store now? Do you have to go to the heavier
box
items
first? Yes, You have a produce bag.
It's going to make it take 10 times longer. That is not the way grocery stores are organized.
It's anarchy. It's just pure anarchy. We have smushed bread, broken eggs.
But a grocery store is organized by the type of food. It's not organized by the weight that you're putting in your bags
They have to get it together. Change it up. Each aisle is now designated as different... square boxed goods, heavier items, light produce.
Anarchy.
Potatoes.
Potatoes. It's anarchy.
Potatoes, which is the melon of the fruit salad of groceries. It's heavy, it's bulky, and it's cheap. You don't even need a bag. Don't bag potatoes. They come pre-bagged.
All I'm saying is I don't see how they're going to get rid of lines, because you're going to have to bag your grocery somewhere. That's going to be a line.
Well, and this is so one of our jobs is then to also decipher in this world of disruption of what is a cool thing to see, like virtual reality or augmented reality, and what will actually change the face of the game. So is this a sign to saying this is where grocery stores are going? Is this meaning all groceries need RFID chips in every item so they automatically get scanned when you walk out? Is this a hybrid where grocery stores will say, pre-scan your item like an Apple store, scan it there, and then it's automatically paid for, so no cashier? Is this going to affect the cashier employment level?
I think it's crazy. I think they're solving a problem that isn't a problem.
Well, see, that's where you go to.
I don't see a problem. I go grocery shopping almost every single day.
Is it more convenient, though? Will it make you... We have how many grocery stores? 5 within a mile of where we live?
Yeah.
Would you go to one that has this instead?
No. I go to the one that's on the way home from school.
Right, whatever's easiest on the side of the road.
Always, it has to do with proximity on the drive. Like, which one do I have to go the out of my way the least to get to? But I just don't see a problem. And I don't understand who grocery shops more than I do that they're seeing a problem that I'm not seeing.
Right.
I see a problem in, like, you know, different products not being provided. I like grocery delivery every once in a while. Yeah. I think that's a great service. I think Amazon delivering, like the Whole Foods part of Amazon, awesome.
Yeah.
But I just don't see how, Prime I think you're just stuff, trading yeah. one line for another line, and it doesn't make sense to me. But when it comes here, I'm sure we'll go and check it out.
Exactly.
It'll be cool.
A lot of disrupting things happening lately.
And I'm fascinated by your grocery store idea, so.
Yeah, well.
You're going to change the industry.
I am. But there's been so much stuff that's happened in the past while. We had a health insurance company buy a pharmacy chain.
Yeah.
We just had it announced a couple of days ago that Warren Buffett and Jeff Bezos and the dude from Chase, JP Morgan Chase, starting their own health provider.
Crazy.
Because they have hundreds of thousands of employees and they need to do it better. Like, it's just, you could feel it. You just feel it. And so, and I say this in talks a lot. And I'm like, the day you think your industry is immune from disruption is the day they flip you. Right upside down. And it's exciting, but it's scary for people in the, you and I don't have jobs, so it's okay. But like, if our job is dependent on this disruption or dependent on not being disrupted, you know, you can't pick an industry now that isn't affected by it on any level or on any scale.
I think too, you have to see who's being affected. Like, if you're talking about not having cashiers, you're taking out a huge job at a certain level of payment, right? And then you're giving costs to people, like the food manufacturers are going to have to change the way they tag the food. That's kind of go on them. That food comes barcoded or whatever out of the producer. So that's going to be a cost that's passed along to farmers and producers. And it just, like, to look cool, it doesn't seem like the right decision, but we'll see.
Well, we've always known, though, that unless it's a union thing, disruption doesn't care about employment.
No, not at all.
Look at manufacturing. Look at all these type of things where it's just you don't hold jobs for the sake of progress. And that's a whole another 5-episode show about the shrinking or the removal of the middle to lower class. And you know, there's only going to be intellectual based jobs and then welfare. And that's where the extreme level people are saying there's not going to be cashier jobs. There's not going to be retail jobs. There's just going to be a bunch of people, and they won't be in the warehouses fulfilling stuff because robots are doing that. So it's a much, much bigger picture and much bigger discussion, which I find really, really fascinating. On with the show. This is a mention from Fox News. It's an article. I apologize for that. I could have got it from somewhere else. Streaming knockout. A boxing fan pays massive bill after friend streamed fight on Facebook Live. The fight, which Joshua saw triumph over Klitschko in the 11th round by TKO, was called the most anticipated boxing match in decades. A British boxing fan has been hit with a £5,000 bill, or pounds, After a friend of his streamed the April 2017 fight on Facebook Live, Craig Foster paid the, which is equivalent to about $27, to watch the fight on Sky Box Office, allowing him to watch the April fight on pay-per-view at home with his friends. But one of Foster's friends, who reportedly had too much to drink, started streaming the fight on Foster's iPad to Facebook Live. Sky found Foster from the watermark on his account number, which showed up on the screen, according to the Mirror, which first reported the news. It was originally reported that Sky tracked down Foster, canceled Foster's subscription, and sent him a bill for $115,000, citing lost revenue from the pay-per-view sales. However, a source close to the situation said Foster was never sent that bill. It just refers to the implied loss to Sky, which is the number of individuals who watched his stream illegally multiplied by the cost of the purchasing the pay-per-view from Sky Box Office. At no point was he asked to pay that. It's been misreported. The Facebook stream was watched by approximately 4,250 people, and approximately 400,000 people in total used Facebook to illegally watch the fight. Foster has acknowledged his wrongdoing, has agreed to pay $6,761 to Sky in legal costs. When reached for comment, Neil Parks, a partner at Foot Ansi LLP, that is such a great British law firm name, said, Mr. Foster broke the law and illegally shared copyright-protected content with thousands of people online. He has since acknowledged his wrongdoing and apologized. Foster knew streaming the fight was wrong, but I didn't stop my friend, but I was watching the boxing. I'm just a bloke who had a few drinks with his friends. Foot Ansi had asked him to turn over the names of the people who watched the stream, but Foster chose not to reveal the information, according to the report. Interesting, right?
Well, it's just, to me, like, I see kind of two parts of it. I realize, I understand. I do. But he wasn't doing it for money. Like, if he was, like, somehow doing it for money.
Right.
Or for ad revenue. Like, if he was, I guess you can't stream it onto YouTube. But do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, if you're stealing the content and you're making money off of it, to me, that's black and white. That's illegal and they should be fine. But, like, what he's doing is kind of like, maybe he didn't expect 4,000 people to watch it. Like, well, if I'm watching something and I FaceTime you and I turn the screen, so mm-hmm. you're watching the same thing I'm watching, mm-hmm. is that illegal?
Yeah, well, so is sharing Netflix logins. Like, you know, like it's...
Well, except this is 4,000 people. That's a lot of people. Right. I was surprised when I heard how many people watched it.
Is it the number? Is it the number of people who watch? Like, where's the threshold to do it? And it's also, it wasn't him. It was his friend using his iPad.
Yeah, but you're responsible for your own phone. I mean, that him being responsible, I don't have a problem with that.
But
I just wonder what the rules are. Like,
and what they're saying, which they're fully in their legal right to do, is the 4,000 people that watched it then didn't have to buy it.
Yeah, they probably wouldn't have bought it anyway, but yeah.
Well, there's the argument, right? So it's a costly lesson for sure. And understanding when you do things like this and stream it, there can be an impact.
For concerts too, like you and I have gone to concerts where you've streamed like something or video and then shared a part of the concert.
Yeah.
Is that wrong? You're not allowed to do that? Well, or is it something you want people to do because then they're going to want to go to your next concert? Like, it's such a weird space.
Or do you know, just put the phone away and enjoy the concert?
But that's a different argument, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. But if you do this, I don't want to have to pay $6,000, so don't do it. So this is kind of like a two-parter, right?
Yeah.
So we have, this is from the Daily Edge. It says, a social influencer has hit back at a Dublin hotel for exposing her, asking for a free hotel stay.
This article was sent to us, the most sent thing sent to us in a very, very long time.
Yeah. Paul Stenson of the White Moose Cafe and Charlesville Lodge in Dublin has a bit of a reputation for being a wind-up merchant. I don't know what that means, but...
Get some going.
In his quest to be king of social media in the world of hospitality and beyond, he's managed to piss off parents, vegans, and pretty much everyone in between. There's a lot of space in between parents and vegans. Case in point, the hotel went viral for their mad guest directory, which warns those staying about exploding hairdryers. Now Paul is facing the wrath of the world of bloggers and influencers.
Mm-hmm.
So what did this gentleman do?
So the story in a executive summary version, L. Darby had written the hotel to say, my boyfriend and I are coming to Dublin and we'd love to stay at your place. And in exchange, you give us the stay for free and we'll share it with people.
And they say they have over 87,000 YouTube subscribers as well as 76,000 Instagram followers.
So she pitched the hotel to give us a free room, and in exchange we'll give it for exposure. So then he replied to her and posted the reply publicly on their page.
So here's the reply. Dear social influencer, I know your name, but apparently it's not important. I use names. Thank you for your email looking for free accommodation in return for exposure. It takes a lot of balls to send an email like that, if not much self-respect and dignity. If I let you stay here in return for a feature in your video, who is going to pay the staff to look after you? Who is going to pay the housekeepers who clean your room? Who is going to pay the waiters who serve you breakfast?
Right. And it keeps going, and it he just goes off on her. But one of the things here is, as far as I know, he didn't name her.
No, it says originally. He's not going to name. He doesn't name her in the thing.
The reason why he opens with that, I guess names aren't important, is she didn't put his name in her original email as well. It was just like, dear hotel.
So we've had a few things like this before, right? Yeah,
but here's the thing. Here's the next stage. She made a video.
Okay.
Crying and upset that this hotel has embarrassed her, and how that was so inappropriate what he wrote, and because he went on and insulted her, and you know, pretty much said you're a waste of space of this type of stuff. It's ridiculous.
It's weird
and
too,
your entitlement is ridiculous, and blah 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 blah. So she went out and made a video, and then mentioned the place, and then it was on.
And I think it's strange because we've seen some stories like this where, you know, an influencer has come to a hotel and kind of made demands. Mm-hmm. That's not what this sounds like to me. She's making a request. Like, yeah. She's going, she's saying, I might as well give it a try. I'll see what happens.
But her whole audience then went and did what you shouldn't do. Went and gave him a bunch of one-star reviews, said, I'm never going to stay there again, and just overwhelmed Yelp, TripAdvisor, and Facebook page. So then he posted this as a response to that.
So this is from the White Moose Cafe Facebook page. All bloggers banned from our business. Following the backlash received after asking an unidentified blogger to pay for a hotel room, I've taken the decision to ban all bloggers from our hotel and cafe. The sense of entitlement is just too strong in the blogging community, and nastiness, hissy fits, and general hate displayed after one of your members was not granted her request for a freebie is giving your whole industry a bad name. I never thought we would be inundated with negative reviews for the simple reason that somebody was required to pay for goods received or services rendered. The girl in question was never identified in my original post, but she herself went on to create a video explaining how she was exposed with malicious intent for asking for a freebie. This kind of victimization is very prevalent in the blogging industry and is in keeping with their general modus operandi of wanting everything for nothing. If any of you attempt to enter our premises from now on, you will be ejected. Many thanks, Paul Stenson. P.S. Perhaps if you went out and got real jobs, you'd be able to pay for goods and services like everybody else. Just a thought. I don't know. You know, I think this dude's a jerk.
I want to go stay there.
No, I don't. I don't like him. I don't think... If you want it to yourself, you run a business and somebody sends you an email asking for something for free, people email you and me all the time wanting you to do a talk for free, wanting books for free, then you don't have to give them the books.
Yeah.
You don't have to do anything. You can reply nicely or ignore them. You have that right. But to reply in a way that is kind of rude, his reply wasn't exactly friendly, even if he didn't say her name. Like, why do that?
But that's his. He's known for that.
He calls him like he sees that guy. He's a jerk.
Dublin.
I know he's a jerk.
Dublin calls it like it's they see it. It's Ireland.
Well, I'm not saying. What are you trying to say?
That they're straight shooters.
No, I don't think this was
the
a nice
Irish
person.
Are straight shooters.
And I think he got into the wrong industry of hospitality.
I think this helps his business.
Yeah, I don't like him. I'm saying she's right.
But here's the thing. I get it. I know. He could have just said delete or no. She could have just said, all right, well, you don't get my reach. I don't buy his thing about saying, how are we going to pay the housekeepers and everything else? Because that part of PR and exposure is getting exposure. I get it. And this is one of the newer ways of doing it. And it can work. And it can work really well. We've been those people that have been the influencers that have, but they've come to us. We have never approached somebody else and said, can we stay there for free?
When we were looking at stuff to do with the kids, we've said, oh, we once had a connection at this place. We should let them know we're coming. Yeah. Maybe they'll, I mean, that's
but
not.
We've never directly asked. We've passively aggressively asked for free stuff. We've hinted.
What I'm saying is that I don't think asking in the way she asked was rude or inappropriate.
No.
He obviously already had a preconceived problem with bloggers and them being entitled. And he took her request and he turned it into more than he had to turn it into. And then she then turned his reply into more than she had to do. And then it blew up.
Because he never named her.
But he obviously insulted her.
That could have ended there. Well, yeah. Well,
could have ended with him just not replying.
Too bad. He's allowed to reply whatever way he wanted. You reached out to him. He's allowed to reply. And then you make it public and all about you crying in a YouTube video and having your whole audience go.
Like
she knew exactly what she was doing with that video. Go get him.
Yeah, but
go show him what we do.
Good. She should.
Giving a place 1-star reviews when you haven't stayed there hurts the ecosystem of trust of reviews. Get mad. So guarantee you'll bookmark it. I'll never stay there. But as soon as you give a place or a product a 1-star review out of vengeance and you've never purchased or you've never stayed, that is unethical.
Okay, but we talk about businesses all the time who the owner of the business is a jerk, not related to their service.
Right.
They're racist, they're rude to somebody, they do something terrible, and so we don't want to give them their money. I'm not saying she did the right thing or that her audience did the right thing, but I do think it's okay to make a decision not to like this place
or
want to go stay at this place.
Yes, 100%.
Because the owner is not a nice person.
100%. You vote with your wallet, but then trying to push the business and make them lose business on something that's based on purchase only, somebody who stayed there can give those reviews, and eventually they'll get removed.
Yeah.
But the point is, though, you're trying to hurt a business. Look, we have a show that exposes bad business. That hurts businesses somewhat. But we don't go and review them and say this, we make fake reviews or we just rip them apart. That hurts the ecosystem of it.
Yeah.
And there's the online mob mentality doesn't help anybody. It helps support each other, but when you take it that farther step, when you start phoning them, when you start phoning fire departments for fires that didn't happen, when you start phoning in fake bomb threats, which is a collection of stories, not this place, but I mean a bunch of different stories from a bunch of different places like this situation, the place that threw out kids and said, we don't want any kids in here anymore, and then people just revolt, and I'm like, the market will speak for itself.
But did she call for her followers to give them bad reviews? I didn't watch the video.
No,
indirectly.
She gets on there upset, crying, and never been so hurt in her life and embarrassed, and this place did it to me. What is your 88,000 subscribers going to do?
I don't know.
What did you say it for?
I wonder what people do after we badmouth companies. Maybe they give them bad reviews, too.
If we ever get more than 7 listeners, there's going to be impact. But yeah, so it's just, I don't like the online mob, and it's one we have been a part of, and I just don't like I like you voting with your wallet. I like you not using a place because you don't like the humans behind it. Yes, please. But there's a line. And once we cross that line, we become no better.
But I would say that as a business owner, if someone asks you for something for free, you should just say no or ignore them.
Yeah, but
say no politely,
but
and then let it go.
I printed up some stuff for the next few weeks' shows of me smacking somebody back because they asked me to connect on LinkedIn in the wrong way or sign me up for their newsletter. People say, well, just delete it. I'm like, nah. Sometimes you just gotta.
Well, we'll see how it works out for
him. Reach back out and love somebody.
We're not going to stay there. That's for sure.
No. All right. Well, we'll still come to Ireland though on podcast world tour. It's not happening. So this is from the DailyBeast.com. Got a little double YouTube thing here. A YouTuber under fire for acid attack prank videos. It's the worst sentence I've ever said. A YouTube star has sparked outrage after filming a series of, quote, acid attack prank videos in which he throws water in people's faces. His latest video, which has reached more than 1.6 million views before being removed for violating YouTube's policy on harassment and bullying, shows him approaching people on the streets of London and dousing their faces in water as they begin to scream. The UK has been plagued by a rising number of acid attacks, which makes the water prank extra terrifying for the unsuspecting victims. Britain has one of the world's highest rates of corrosive substance attacks, The Guardian reported in December. More than 20 people were injured in a London nightclub last April when a man drenched a crowd with acid. Araya Mosala, the YouTuber who perpetrated the prank, has more than 666,000 followers and opens his video by saying, "You guys know what happens when I'm back with my cup. I'm going to be throwing water in people's faces." He says he'll continue to do the prank if the video of his latest stunt reaches 150,000 likes. While plenty of his followers praised him for the hilarious joke, others were outraged that he would make light of such a serious issue in pursuit of views. One person said, I lost an eye to an acid attack. This is horrendous, one man tweeted. If this person was brandishing a toy gun to joke terrorize people, the police would be called to manage the situation. This is no different. Next, given the rise of acid attacks of late, I find this extremely disturbing, et cetera, et cetera. Masala's video is just the latest in a series of problematic stunts pulled by YouTube stars in an attempt to go viral. This month, YouTube cut business ties with vlog powerhouse Logan Paul after he posted a video featuring the body of a suicide victim. Masala himself has largely grown his channel through assault-style pranks. Now, that's the worst sentence I've said. In which he grabs people's hats off their heads, pours ketchup on their shoes, pulls chairs out from under them, jumps on the hood of their cars, smacks drinks out of people's hands, steals their iPhones. In one video, his channel that garnered over 2 million views this past fall, he runs around pulling people's pants down in an attempt to expose their underwear or genitalia. In response to the backlash, Masala issued a video Monday night claiming the media companies were, quote, slandering his name over a harmless prank, though also admitting that he still shouldn't have produced the video in the first place. Quote, I've been doing pranks on YouTube for about 3 years. I've never once come across anything about community guidelines or strikes, he said. If one video of mine literally offended you guys, then all my other videos would literally anal you guys. You're crying over one video that was a joke and never meant to be for these old boring people. He also took issue with how haphazardly YouTube seems to enforce its community guidelines. Quote, there are videos on YouTube of bombings and stabbings and pornography have not been deleted. I've seen it myself. I've been doing way more controversial pranks than have been deleted or demonetized. I've done a bomb prank that got no attention. What a moron. In an interview with MSNBC over the weekend, YouTube CEO Susan Wojcicki said the platform is working hard to ferret out and remove problematic content that explicitly violates the company's community guidelines. Quote, we announced that we would hire 10,000 people to help us manage and enforce these policies we have across the content on YouTube. We've always had community guidelines on YouTube, and we always enforce those guidelines. Susan said, also, YouTube has begun using machine learning to find problematic videos proactively and let humans review them and potentially take them down. In the meantime, prank videos, which have become YouTube influencers' favorite genre, can often straddle the line. Many YouTubers know just how far to push things without technically violating YouTube's terms. There's a lot of nuances, she said. I found my new most hated person.
Really?
This guy.
Do you like those kinds of things, though? A little bit.
Not that, though.
You like when people injure themselves.
You fall. That's funny. You trip on something. It's a fail video. Yeah, it's accidental.
I don't like those videos. And pretending
you're pouring acid on people's faces.
No. I think it's terrible, obviously.
Saying, well, they didn't take down my bomb prank one.
But they do other prank. The problem with the whole issue with it is that to get more and more followers, they have to keep outdoing themselves. So the first one is a little bit of a prank, and then it becomes, and then where's the line? So once they start pranking people, and then that's old, and then other people start copying them, so they have to keep pushing it and pushing it and pushing it, right? To try and get as many views as possible.
And it goes with an adolescent brain makeup chemistry, right? If you were 16 or 17 years old and you had 500,000 people watching and cheering you on every time you put a video out.
You're going to do stupid things too.
Right? You know, they say your brain's not fully developed, what, 25?
Yeah.
And the way it fires off and how the self-centeredness and the self-actualization.
Plus people egg you on. Like, right. They're encouraging you. Yeah. They're telling you, all those viewers are telling you what you're doing is fantastic, right? Yeah.
When Logan Paul, when he went to the suicide forest and did that video, and there's the number of people supporting him, just saying, you know, or when he came out and apologized, he said sorry, so he's fine. It's amazing to watch that these people have been thrust into the spotlight and have these giant followings, you know, playing off of influencers.
Yeah.
Right. You know, the audience isn't everything for brands, for companies. So you got to be careful by using people because they do these type of things too.
They'll do whatever.
I can't think
basically,
of,
right? Like they'll just push and push and push.
Yeah, until exactly. You got, because it's always about the view. And if a view,
and
if,
in some ways YouTube wants the views too. So then it becomes this kind of like where you want people to constantly, what it seems like YouTube would really want is people who push the line right up to a certain point where it's, but they want people at that line.
Right.
Because once they go over the line, then they have to step in and say, no, we can't do with this.
Right.
But they don't want people way below the line because that doesn't get as many views. So they want this kind of like extreme stuff that's constantly pushing. And the line keeps getting just like a little bit bigger. And I let that happen. So they're going to let this happen. Right. And that's the problem.
And that leads us to our other story here from Gizmodo, which is YouTube unveils new monetization rules, killing ad revenue for small creators. amid seemingly endless controversies about YouTube content, which is what we just talked about, Google announced major changes last night to how videos will be monetized. Going forward, the company said big channels included in its coveted Google Preferred program will be manually vetted for ad friendliness. Far more drastically, the video sharing site is making it a lot harder for small channels to make money off the platform, and uploaders are pissed. Now, YouTube has struggled over the last few months to grapple with inappropriate content on its service. They haven't, by the way.
That has to be forever.
They've grappled with advertisers pulling their advertising because their ads have been shown on those channels.
This isn't the beginning of inappropriate content on YouTube.
Aside from a YouTube star sharing a deeply insensitive video, the site has recently faced scrutiny over white supremacist and conspiracy theory videos on its platform. Just in November, YouTube came under fire for hosting disturbing content aimed at children. In a subsequent blog post, Susan Wojcicki, CEO, said the company will expand its team that moderates policy. We already said that, too. But the new monetization strategy doesn't so much as appease those worried about the policy violation as it signals small creators they aren't worth the trouble to the tech giant. Under the new guidelines, channels will need to have 1,000 subscribers and 4,000 hours of watch time within the last year.
That's a lot.
To be eligible for receiving ad revenue. Previously, uploaders needed just 10,000 total views to run ads on their videos. All Google Preferred channels will also now be manually reviewed, with ads only running on videos that have been approved. Enforcement of these guidelines will start February 20th. The changes are sure to appease nervous advertisers worried about being associated with videos of dead bodies or creepy clips aimed at children, but they also show that the company ultimately doesn't see much value in smaller channels, and if they aren't really impacting Google's bottom line, they have little motivation to cater to them. For those non-offending, albeit smaller-scale creatives looking to profit off the platform, it's a reminder that, to Google, they're just scraps at the bottom of the barrel. I 100% fully agree with YouTube on this.
Well, to me, it's just a matter of numbers. They have to police them, and they can only police so many. So obviously, they're going to police the biggest ones.
Right.
I mean, that makes
it's that long. Sense. It's that long tail thing, right? I'm making numbers up here, but 100,000 creators of video that'll get a few thousand video views of their videos.
Yeah.
And I can't police those. It's just not scalable to do that. And advertisers are like, this is a huge threat to us. And we're pulling all of our advertising. We're like, all right, they're out of you can still have your videos. You can still have your subscribers.
You're just not having ads on
your channels. And they're not making a lot of money on those videos anyways, those ads.
No, I totally agree.
You have to talk to them. You have to, because, you're just small scraps. Because you are.
Yeah.
That's how business works. Mind you, we still qualify. We have over 5,000 subscribers and plenty of hours of views. Of those type of things, but we don't make money off. I don't even make a penny off them. We don't choose to monetize them for the most part, so we don't put the ads on it. But it's something to say. It's okay to have aspirational levels to go to as well. Your goal is to get to 1,000 subscribers. Your goal is to get that. And once you get there, then you get in the program. That's okay to have a barrier to entry to it. You just can't police hundreds of thousands of creators.
And as a brand, if I was coming in looking for advertising, that's what I'd want to hear. Yeah. So. Do we have time to do a made-up word, or is it...
Yeah.
Yeah? Want to do this one? I want to do this one.
This one.
Okay. You go. What is the word today?
We had to pause. I was pausing.
I was just about to pause.
Made-up word. Don't make any sense. Made-up word. Don't mean no offense. Made-up word. It brings laziness. What is all this craziness? Made-up. They're
made up. Pause. Good. All right, so this made-up word is conversocial. I'm not even going to ask Wayne or you what you think it is, because it's funny. It's the name of a company that put out a survey and a study. Conversocial, obviously, is conversations over social.
I hate companies that are named made-up word names.
Right? Like unmarketing.
Unmarketing.
It's actually, I like their study, what they came out with. It's more of I'm going to give you a couple key findings. We'll give you a link to download the whole report. But they came out with this full report from the U.S. that says things like over half of respondents to their survey, 54.4%, preferred the new messaging channels, SMS, Facebook Messenger, Twitter, WhatsApp, as their primary form of communication with brands over legacy channels such as email, phone, and web chat.
Email's a legacy.
Right? How old are you when email is an old school way? Nearly half of respondents indicated that a personalized response from a brand would strengthen their brand loyalty. Respondents age 18 to 34, those millennials again, have used social for customer service more than any other age group. And if they hadn't yet, they're most likely to do so in the future. No, I don't believe that. Nearly half of the respondents making over 150K a year have used social customer service. 86% of respondents making over 150K a year were more likely to be loyal to a brand if they engaged with them on social. And 100% of respondents considered ease of use as a key aspect of social customer service, with 45% qualifying it as the most important aspect.
Conversocial.
Conversocial. It's all about the conversocial. If you want to conversocial with us, drop us a line. Add on Allison on Twitter, add on marketing as well. Facebook.com/unmarketing, Instagram, Allison Robin, unmarketing me. You know what I'm saying. We want to take a leak.
What's wrong with you?
Say, take a look. I've gone.
We'll talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and visit theunpodcast.com. And remember, friends don't let friends use QR codes.